Welcome to State of the State, the monthly roundup of policy and research for the state of Michigan, brought to you by the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and the good folks at WKAR Studios. I'm Arnold Weinfeld, Associate Director for the Institute. Today I'm joined, as usual, by MSU economist Dr. Charlie Ballard, who directs our State of the State survey. Later on, we'll be joined by Dr. Chris Torres, an assistant professor in K-12 Educational Administration here at Michigan State. Dr. Torres will be discussing research from the Education Policy Innovation Center here at MSU pertaining to Michigan's partnership model of school reform, which was launched in 2017. Education, always an important issue, Charlie. We've got a primary, mostly a Democratic primary coming up here in a few weeks. What do we think the key issues might be as the candidates come to Michigan?
Well, I guess the first question is which candidates will come to Michigan, because I think it's entirely possible that some of the candidates may suspend their campaigns between now and the Michigan primary. But certainly, healthcare seems to be high on the list no matter where you go. Here in Michigan, more perhaps than in any other place, water-related issues, I think. If the candidates, they have to say something about water. They have to say something about water shutoffs in Detroit. They have to say something about the Flint water situation, and perhaps more generally about the Great Lakes, which are in flux. Yeah. We're seeing all sorts of changes along the coastline.
I don't disagree with that. Aside from the very local issues that you just mentioned, there are probably two statewide issues. One, certainly, are the levels of the Great Lakes. And I'd be surprised if the candidates didn't tie that to climate change.
Yes.
And their stances on climate change and any proposals that they have for climate change. And then PFAS. PFAS has become a very large environmental issue, a disaster here in the state of Michigan. And not just here in Michigan, but in other states as well. So
a lot of environmental issues, I think, are likely to be close to the fore. And then we'll see how it shakes out, but certainly the proposals for wealth taxation, for additional spending, for college, and for other and for healthcare, Medicare for all, or not, those issues, I think, are likely to be important in the Michigan primary. Certainly, when I talk to people around town, those are the things that are on their minds. There's a lot of very thoughtful debate about exactly how progressive our tax system should be, and should we have free tuition? How much should we help college students and those who have recently graduated, sometimes with a lot of student loan debt? Those are important important questions.
You know, of course, there's always a lot of scuttlebutt. No different this time when we have a governor who's been termed a rising star in the party. Some rumors floating around this town about whether or not Governor Whitmer is being seen as a vice presidential candidate. One of the interesting things, I think, will be how the candidates tie back any of their proposals to proposals the governor has put forward, whether it's on water or on infrastructure, for instance.
Right. Fix the dam roads is probably a bigger issue in Michigan than anywhere else. But infrastructure is, I think, a national issue. It's something that I wish the candidates were saying more about, because we have this especially nasty situation with our roads. But and our roads are probably the worst in the country. But all across the country, the electric power grid is not in good shape. Our underground, our water and sewer are in many parts of the country are deteriorated. The civil engineers who do an annual evaluation give Michigan the same as the national average, which is a D+ for infrastructure.
Right. So I don't believe the governor has endorsed any of the candidates. So in my view, I'll be looking to see which of the candidates pull her in as they come here and campaign. You mentioned something about the tax structure and moving more towards some statewide issues. The governor proposed her budget, And there was some angst I saw amongst some folks, in particular seniors, who saw nothing about the pension tax. That was a campaign promise of the governor to get rid of the so-called pension tax. Yes. Clearly, that would be a hit on the budget. Give us your thoughts for a moment on where you see this.
Well, as someone who probably will be retiring in a few years, I want to put forth a perspective that's a little different from what you often hear about from seniors on this subject. What we had before 2011, when the law was changed, was a tax system that was extraordinarily generous toward senior citizens. 95% of them pay no income tax. And if you take into account the homestead property tax credit, on net, seniors were paying less than nothing. That is, they were getting money back from the income tax. And then we moved not all the way, but just baby steps in the direction of a more level playing field between seniors and others. That caused a big uproar. And we know that seniors are more likely to vote than younger folks. And she campaigned on rolling back the so-called pension tax, which you might call the taxing seniors the same as everybody else tax. You can probably tell from my tone, I just don't think that my citizenship duties stop in a couple of years when I retire. We have all sorts of ways to help low-income seniors. I think a lot of this gets conflated with, oh, the seniors are low-income. Well, that's what we have a personal exemption tax. That's what we have in the tax. That's what why we have various social services. Under the old system that Governor Whitman has said she wanted to go back to, seniors, depending upon where their income comes from, could have well over $100,000 of income and not pay a penny of income tax. Whereas the guy who does drywall and is barely scraping by would have to pay some income tax. And I just don't see the fairness in that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an interesting discussion to have. Your point about one's social responsibility doesn't stop when you retire or become a senior. On the other hand, there are more seniors coming on.
That means that the budgetary cost of this gets bigger and bigger the longer we go, as our population is aging fairly rapidly. Mm-hmm. So 10 years from now, the proportion of our population who will be retired is several percentage points higher than it is now. So that's, in my view, another reason to tax seniors similarly to the rest of the folks, because the revenue needs are so profound. And I think that's why the governor's – she didn't issue a big press release saying I'm not going to do one of my campaign promises. But why would the budget not include that? Well, it costs money, a couple $100 million a year. And the state of Michigan is just – severely strapped for cash.
You know, and that's interesting. And this is what I think really confuses a lot in the public. Hearing a report yesterday from the Council of Economic Advisers that the economy is growing, continuing to grow, expected to grow at 2%. Of course, there are those such as the president that would like to see it grow more than that and are calling for more tax cuts to do so. And yet, you talk about how the state of Michigan is strapped for cash, and the fact of the matter is that our general fund budget is the same as it was in 1960s when adjusted for inflation.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is that we have cut taxes in this state.
Tax cuts have been very popular, but then a lot of voters, I think, have trouble making the connection between the fact that we've slashed taxes and the fact that our roads are in bad shape. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult thing to make clear to voters, but I think that Political leaders, in my view, are obligated to at least try to make that connection. Look, tax cuts are not free. And we have cut taxes a lot. And now the situation in Lansing is a little different from the situation in Washington. Both places are obsessed with tax cuts. But here in Michigan, we have a balanced budget requirement, which means that, roughly speaking, if we cut taxes, that means we got to not pave some roads. That means we got to not do some social services. We got to cut K-12. We got to do something. Whereas in Washington, because they don't have a balanced budget requirement, we're now running a $1.2 trillion a year deficit at a time when the economy is essentially at full employment, mm-hmm. which is just astonishing. And that's another thing that I guess I'm on my hobby horse here that bothers me, because we're acting as if we think that the world credit markets have an infinite appetite for U.S. debt. And so far, they continue to lend to us at pretty reasonable rates as our debt goes up past $20 trillion. But you add $1 trillion a year, and then if there's ever a recession, we know that that number will be bigger. Boy, oh boy, sooner or later, we're going to have, I think, a currency crisis. And that is something that I'm not looking forward to. This is why I'm not running for office, but I should pay more taxes.
Well, at the same time as that Council of Economic Advisors report came out, we also see the stock market is nearing 30,000 points.
Right.
And yet right below the economic forecast was an announcement from Goldman Sachs to watch for a stock market correction. And so if you've got 401ks, you've got a stock portfolio, it might be time to have a chat if you have a financial advisor, take a look at that and make sure that you're protected, because things don't last forever. That's
well, my wife and I are going to be talking to our guy just next week maybe making some adjustments to our portfolio. You're absolutely right that the stock market has done extraordinarily well in recent years. Can it continue to grow at stratospheric rates forever? No. And sooner or later, there will be a correction. We just don't know exactly when. But I think just generally, people should know that over the long haul, stocks are a great investment. Over any long holding period, several years, you should have some of your asset portfolio in stocks. But of course, if you had bought stocks in August of 2008 and sold 3 months later, you would have done very badly. The stock market, even though the long-term trend is mm-hmm. strong, it's volatile in the short term. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like risk, you should just be aware of that.
Right. And it is interesting to note how much smaller the world seems to become every day. The coronavirus situation having an impact on economies in Asia, in particular in China. Even outside of that, I read where Japan's economic output last year fell by 6%. And so those economies are as tied to our economy as much as the Western European economy is tied to our economy. We are truly all tied to each other. And the success of China's economy or Japan's economy or Britain's or Germany's, the United States is very much dependent on that, as they are dependent on the success of our economy as well.
That's right. And, the International Studies and Programs is going to have a forum in a couple of weeks about the coronavirus and its health effects, as well as its economic effects. The estimate that I heard is that car production is mm-hmm. worldwide is going mm-hmm. to fall mm-hmm. For the first time since more than a decade ago because if you think about it, Wuhan, the city that's at the center of the coronavirus crisis, Wuhan has more people than the state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine if everyone in Michigan had to stay home.
It was on lockdown, the entire state.
That would be just astonishing.
Unbelievable. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn now to another topic that always seems to be at the forefront of the public's mind, and that's education. With us this morning is Dr. Chris Torres, who's part of a team of researchers here on campus performing an ongoing evaluation of those state schools and school districts involved in a specific effort to improve student outcomes through a partnership approach between the Michigan Department of Education, intermediate school districts, and local communities. Their research is also being supported by a grant from the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research through our Michigan Applied Public Policy Research Program that supports linking faculty to informing the discussion on current public policy issues. Chris, thanks for being here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us and help inform us and our listeners, what is this Partnership Act and policy, and maybe how it's different from other school turnaround policies?
Absolutely. Great question. So the partnership reform started in spring 2017, and really the idea is that they identified the lowest performing schools and districts around Michigan, sort of the bottom 5% at first. And there were three rounds of identification that happened in spring 2017, fall 2017, and spring 2018. 123 schools were identified in 36 districts. And the way that they're sort of different, this reform is a little bit different from past turnaround policies in other states and nationally. There are a few kind of waves of this sort of reform. There's a sort of a takeover approach where lowest performing schools are identified and, for example, a charter management organization, a charter school management company will come in and take over a school. There's reconstitution where they'll replace the principal and half the staff. And then there are more sort of what I call support-oriented approaches, where there's more of an infusion of resources, maybe some money or a particular program is put in place to turn around these schools. And what Michigan has done is to say we're going to give districts, school districts, that these schools are located within we're going to make them do a strategic plan that covers 3 years' time. And over a 36-month period, they're tasked with, first they set their goals by writing this partnership agreement and saying, these are the outcomes we're going to achieve academically. These are the things that the process goals that we have, the things that we want to accomplish in terms of, for instance, implementing a new curriculum, for instance. And by the end of the 36 months, we're going to prove to you, Michigan Department of Education, that we've met these goals using our data. And if not, there are a variety of, then you'll have the sort of hammer approach you'll be taken over, you'll be closed or mm-hmm. whatnot. And so there's the strategic planning element, but there's also resources associated with this. And so what the Michigan Department of Education does is they assign a partnership agreement liaison who's sort of someone who can talk to the district, help them brainstorm new approaches, connect them with other people around the state who might be helpful in helping them meet these partnership goals. They give a 21H grant to certain districts where districts can apply and say, hey, we need support implementing a new curriculum, but we need more money to do that. And so they'll apply to the state and get a grant. There's also additional grants in terms of something called the Regional Assistance Grant that runs through the ISDs, and that allows districts to use some resources from the ISD, for instance, maybe a literacy coach. They'll be able to pay for a literacy coach through the ISD, and that's a new form of resource, right?
And there are 33 of these districts. So can you give us an idea? Because 33, I mean, you know, right. Folks in this state are familiar with some of the problems at in Detroit or Benton Harbor or Flint, but 33.
Right.
So are there urban, suburban, and rural, these districts all over the state?
They're all over the state, yeah. Most of the schools are concentrated in Detroit, but yeah, they're, I think you said some Flint, mm-hmm. Benton Harbor, Detroit, but also rural districts like Baldwin, for instance, are on it, Wayne Westland. There are a variety of lower income, mm-hmm. a lot of a lot of these partner districts are among Michigan's most disadvantaged sort of settings. You know, I think we ran some of the numbers, and the median household income in partnership districts on average is $33,000 compared to $60,000 median income in non-partnership districts.
So half as much income.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising that these poor districts would be the ones that have challenges in their public schools.
Right. Yeah, and we know historically that's not just a Michigan thing. That's pretty much all over the country. Yeah.
And it's not just an urban thing. It's all over the state. And,
that's
I think something that's really important to emphasize, because I think a lot of people have in their mind that these problems are urban, because those are the ones that Detroit, of course, gets a lot of attention.
Right.
But our rural areas in Michigan, many of them are quite economically depressed, and that's not a formula for success for the schools.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been really interesting to learn more about those contexts and some of the common problems they share beyond poverty. I mean, pretty consistently what we heard. I did the qualitative work, which involves going around the state and just talking to superintendents, talking to teachers, principals, people involved in this work, and systematically kind of analyzing what are your issues, and looking at what explains the common problems they share, and what's different about the rural setting versus urban setting. And so, but quite consistently what we heard, I mean, everyone said this, is just the staffing problems. You see it in the news about substitute shortages. Some districts, a third of their teaching staff were short-term subs. People with no teaching experience whatsoever, just stepping into classrooms, stepping out of classrooms, just constant turnover. That's the main theme that we heard. When you're trying to implement a new curriculum, if someone is in that class who's never been around kids, hasn't managed a classroom, how are you going to implement a rigorous world-class curriculum?
matter how good the curriculum looks on paper.
Right.
You got to do it on the ground in the classroom.
Right. And so we'd hear strategic responses from districts like, we want to put this really great curriculum and have high expectations for our kids, but if you don't have anyone to implement that, then how are we going to meet our goals? Or on the other hand, some would tell us, we'll implement the most scripted curriculum possible. This is exactly what you do. This is exactly what you say, because they were saying it's the only way we can make sure we get coverage. We have, based on who we've got in the classrooms, we need to do this, even though we know it's not, the best.
Taking away all of the flexibility and spontaneity, but if you've got a rookie teacher, maybe having a script that says, okay, at 9:23 a.m., here's what you do.
Exactly. So there's really, they're in a bind,
So have you found some successes, and what explains those successes and or challenges that some of these districts are still facing?
Yeah, right. That's a great question. So the quantitative portion of the team, because I work with a number of different researchers, the qualitative work was just my portion of the project. But on the quantitative side, we've got this really rich administrative data that's been developed through a partnership with the Michigan Department of Education, University of Michigan, and EPIC here. Mm-hmm. They have done these regression-based analyses and looked at sort of what are the effects of the partnership reform on in the first year. And so what they've found, or what we found, is that there has been a significant, highly significant effect of the reform, but it's mostly concentrated in Detroit. And so what that means is I'm not much of a quantitative researcher, but my understanding is they've compared the statistical effects of this reform to other turnaround reforms in other studies, and the effect was among the largest compared to other studies of turnaround. And so what explains those successes? I went out and interviewed Dr. Vitti, the superintendent of Detroit. So, this is one interview. But they've got some documents at the district that explain what they did. But there's There's kind of a spotlighting effect, is my understanding of it. This is just my personal read on that conversation is, you know, okay, you've identified where we've got our biggest problems. Now let's go in and really focus in resources, time, and so, for example, let's put our principles into a cohort. Those principles become a cohort, and we do intensive coaching on data and how to do small group instruction with our most struggling readers.
So it sounds like instead of spreading resources out thin like peanut butter and trying to address everything, you focus in on one particular aspect that you're trying to address.
Right.
And that seems to have had some success.
Yeah. And that's what we saw in Detroit. There was, you know, there is more of an infusion of capacity building resources, saying other districts would do different things, you know, smaller districts than Detroit would, they found the 21H money extremely helpful. You know, like we talked to charter schools that are identified for turnaround that are smaller, and $200,000 is a huge bump for them versus maybe a drop in the bucket in Battle Creek where, you know, you've got Kellogg Foundation infusing a lot of money. And so that small charter school might say, oh, now we can, you know, provide bonuses to our teachers, or we can buy this new curriculum that we really wanted, but we just didn't have the budget, or we can hire a coach that we haven't been able to hire to help coach our teachers on this particular thing. So smaller districts are finding it meaningful through the resources, and these kind of larger districts that had maybe already had the capacity we're finding it helpful in terms of, you know, okay, we've identified the problem. Now we can reorganize our resources in a way that makes sense for these folks.
So you said that, you know, this is a team project, obviously, and just the first year. How long is the project slated to go, and what's next?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's a four-year, so we have a four-year grant from the Michigan Department of Education. So, you know, we're trying to follow this through all 3 years. So, you know, we wanted to start right when schools and districts were identified, and then sort of see, well, what happens at the end of that 36 months, right?
Right.
Are they actually going to be closed? Are what will the state do if, you know, certain districts and schools don't meet their goals? Because there was this promise to sort of say, we're going to close you, or, you know, or take you over, or appoint a CEO, or whatever it may be, like happened in Benton Harbor. And so we're trying to follow it through to the end there. But there's, you know, no one's quite certain what's going to happen. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the budget, including in education, has been an issue. There's been a change in state, the state superintendent, and, you know, political changes that might shape, you know, is this going to continue and in what form? And so we're going to follow it through the 3 years, but this year is the second year, and we're, you know, learning some new things about how districts are responding and how they're doing after 18 months, because there's an 18-month kind of checkup to see if they're on track.
And this sounds to me like we should have Dr. Torres back in a couple of years.
Yeah,
or at least every now and then, for sure. And so this is a state law, this partnership act, am I not correct?
That's where I'm a little bit – I don't want to say anything that –
I'm pretty sure it was called the Partnership Act.
Right.
But the 33 – so throughout the course of this project, this 3 years or 4 years
– right.
That number is probably not going to grow. We're going to stick to the 33 to see how.
I think
this
there
works
have
out.
Been new schools identified, actually. So there some have dropped off since last year. Some have dropped off the list, like Lansing, for example, is off.
I see.
And there have been schools that have been added. So what is uncertain to me is, you know, to what degree it's going to continue. Are we going to continue seeing schools and districts added on? But we're kind of just tracking the ones that started in 2017. And
see. Yeah. And so one of the things I heard you say that I think is that I want to reiterate, it sounds like this is not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. It sounds like each school district has the ability to come up with a plan in collaboration with their ISD, their local community, and the Department of Education that fits their needs.
That's right. Yeah, it is. That is one of, I think, the strengths of this approach. It's not a mandate. That's the spirit of the name, right? Partnership. Mm-hmm. And the intent is to get all these stakeholders in one place to form a collaborative plan and to identify community partners, partners in the community that can help meet the goals, to identify technical partners that can build their capacity to meet those goals, and to really be strategic about this plan and bring different people to the table. Mm-hmm. Now, that happened really, another part of this is did that actually happen? And we found some did. others were sort of what we call symbolically adopting the reform in that they're just doing what they were doing before.
Yeah.
Kind of cutting and pasting their prior plans into the partnership agreement.
Well, as Dr. Ballard noted, I think that we're going to have you back from time to time as this moves forward. It's never any one small thing that helps correct situations, and it usually takes some time. People are always looking for that one big thing and a quick fix, and that's just not the way change happens.
The magic elixir, silver bullet.
Right. So, thank you, Dr. Torres, for being here and
thanks
your
again
team
for having me. Yeah.
For your work on this important matter. It's another great example of acting on our Institute's mission of supporting the work of faculty toward informing the public policy discussion. Charlie, always a pleasure. Any final thoughts?
This has been a great discussion, and I look forward to the next time we speak with Chris, checking out to see how things have evolved.
Well, hopefully Dr. Grossman will be back with us next month. We'll have been through our primary.
Yes.
We'll see who comes out of that, and as you noted, we might have the field winning down to just a few.
Yes.
There might be a clear front runner by then, but I want to thank you, as always, for your insightfulness.
My pleasure.
And my thank you to Russ White as well and the folks here at WKAR for their support of this program. Join us again next month on State of the State.